Hey, welcome to our podcast, Sounding Off with Kim Munson. I am so excited to have on the line with me Dr. Jill Vecchio. You know her. She was one of the few people in America that actually read the PPACA, the Obamacare Act, the Health Care Act. Dr. Jill Vecchio, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
We've been talking about some really important issues out there, and a listener had sent to me this release. It was on April 5th, 2020, by the state of Colorado, and it's updating the crisis standards of care and response to COVID-19. And the person that sent this to me said, take a note that there is no patient advocate nor family representative that is part of this decision-making process on this standard of care. Now, Jill, you're a physician, so explain to our listeners what the standard of care is exactly.
Well, each hospital has several sets of standard of care. You always have policies and procedures to make sure that care and decision-making is as uniform as possible, and you try to meet the highest possible medical and ethical standards. Standard of care really is kind of a legal definition, so that if there's a bad outcome and a patient is injured, that if something went to trial, let's say the patient sues the doctor for malpractice in a court of law, the defense the two sides are going to try to say that standard of care was not met, so that there was negligence. And in order for negligence to happen, there has to be some problem with meeting a standard of care. So you have to, it's like a setting a bar. Is standard of care. Obviously, we want to do better than standard of care, but in this case with the COVID-19, standard of care was where the hospital is saying, this is how we need to approach this, or the state of Colorado or the CDC. I mean, the standard of care guidelines can come from all the way from a government entity down, and usually the highest level at which the standard of care is set usually tends to be the lowest potential standard of care, so that each new level, like the hospital, can do a lot more than what the CDC recommends. Do you know what I mean? So
okay.
Standard of care is really kind of a legal term that just says if you do this, then you're going to be protected legally and financially from any arguments about negligence or something like that. So that's really what a standard of care really means from a medical standpoint.
And this was issued on April 5th, so maybe about a month. Well, it was a month probably to the day from when Colorado noted their first COVID-19 death. And granted, on this, Jill, there were a lot of unknowns at that particular point in time. But this, and one of the things that you mentioned about Obamacare or nationalized health care is that ultimately it gets to rationing. So as I look at this press release that was sent out, or this release that was sent out from the Office of Communications from the state of Colorado, it looks to me like it's indicating that what decisions would be made in the case that, say, for example, ventilators would have to be rationed. And you've always said that when we get government involved, that's where we start to see rationing in healthcare. So what's your comments on that, Jill?
I think, to put it into perspective, at that point in time, what we saw was what was happening in Italy. Italy was an absolute disaster. There were hospitals that couldn't even keep track of the dead. Mass graves. Unbelievable, overwhelmed hospital systems. And then we started to see it happening in New York and New Jersey. That was frightening. When this standard of care that you're talking about, April 5th, we were expecting it to potentially there to be a sweeping of COVID from east to west, and maybe west to central, west to east in the United States. We thought that that's what would happen because that's how epidemics work. We expected for the system to be overrun. Anytime you have, and in those cases, if you have a system like Italy, they had limited resources. I mean, they did not have enough ventilators. They did not have things they needed. So they had to consider making that decision, who gets it and who doesn't. And any time in any situation where you've got a limited resource, you're going to have to decide who gets it and who doesn't. And that's in a crisis situation. We never reached that crisis situation. We're at like a third. We're using a third of the available ventilators that we've got in Colorado. I just looked this morning. So we didn't thankfully have to make those decisions, but it's not unreasonable for at all for them to come up with a standard of care protocol that says, if this happens, we need to do this. I thought they were a little premature on jumping all over wanting to treat this as a limited resource so quickly. Governor Cuomo was absolutely hysterical. To watch him, he was hysterical saying, I have 400 ventilators. I need, 14,000 ventilators. Well, no, he never did. He never did. It was just...
Well, and he actually had
overreaction. It was an overreaction in a lot of ways. I don't think it was bad to come up with a standard of care. You want to be prepared for the potential worst. But I believe that they wholeheartedly overreacted.
Well, and it seemed like he was trying to politicize this whole thing. He's crying, I don't have enough ventilators. First of all, his responsibility is the state of New York. And over all these years, there's been decisions made on where money is spent. And his responsibility is that state, and they should have made sure that they have ventilators in place in case there is some kind of an epidemic. So he, as the CEO of New York and those before him, have made poor decisions. But then he wanted to try to blame President Trump for that. President Trump says, you want ventilators, we'll get you ventilators. And then a few days later, somebody notes that, hey, you've got a bunch of ventilators over here in a warehouse. He goes, oh, so sorry. The other thing is, it is now proven that he actually forced nursing homes to take back in COVID-19 positive patients. What's your thoughts on that, Jill?
Well, I think that's all part of the overreaction. If you think about, he thought his system was going to be so overwhelmed, he's hysterical. At the same time, he's not shutting down the subways. I mean, the decisions that were made in New York were so ridiculous. And it just kept, it was as if he doesn't want to be held responsible for his decisions, but he wants to make Trump and the administration jump through as many hoops as possible. So he just keeps raising the bar. I need 1,000 ventilators. I need 14,000 ventilators. Whatever he got was like a fraction of what he needed. And he needed to have a Navy ship, and he needed to have all this, a whole COVID-19 transformation of that, whatever the Javits Center or something. Incredibly expensive, so time-consuming, so personnel-consuming. It's unbelievable what Trump did for him, and wow, there was not a lot of gratitude. At the same time, he's still hysterical about what could possibly happen, and I would imagine that had something to do with his decision to clear out the hospital beds of nursing home patients that were COVID-positive and send them back to the nursing homes. Let's understand one thing, and I've talked about this over the years. There are two philosophies, kind of two basic philosophies, two ways you can look at healthcare systems. One was Hippocrates. So I took the Hippocratic Oath in medical school, where we said every life is sacred from conception through infirmity and death. As a physician, I'm going to take care of that patient as an individual. I'm going to do what's best for that patient based on the relationship that that patient and I have and decisions we make together. That is based on the assumption that there's not a limited resource, right? That the system is not a limited resource, that if I'm providing a service to patients and if patients are freely interacting in a transaction of care and payment, that is not a limited resource. That is an open system, a relatively free market transaction. The second way is more of Plato, like Plato's Republic. Plato, he was all about limited resources. His approach to healthcare was you treat it as a system of limited resources. Once you establish that and accept that premise, then you are completely free to determine who gets and who doesn't, who lives, who dies. Under Plato's system, babies who were born with deformities, developmentally disabled, seizure disorders, they should be killed at birth or killed at a young age before society has invested a great deal of time and effort and money into them. So get rid of those people because they're just going to be a drag in the system. Same thing with the elderly. Oh, they've lived their lives, had their fun, they've made their contributions, they're no longer contributing to society, they're expendable. Get rid of them. Let them die. So if you think about Cuomo's decisions with the nursing homes from that standpoint, when you think about some of the standard of care protocols, it's all based on who's expendable. It's all going to be based on Plato's limited resources. To me, when Cuomo sent the nursing home patients back to the nursing homes, that was enacting this 100%. Obamacare was rife with the same Plato limited resource stuff. Sterilization for girls as young as their first menstrual period, if they chose to have it. And a lot of times those could be people that were disabled, right? So let's sterilize them. I mean, and that's been done in the past, I think it was under FDR. It was a state law that several states adopted, I think, to mandatorily forced sterilization of people who had mental disorders or were developmentally disabled. Forced sterilization. We actually did this in this country for decades, and then it went to the Supreme Court, and they knocked it down finally. So we have a long history of this, obviously, since Hippocrates and Plato, right, that this has always been a societal discussion to have. But when you see things like Cuomo's decisions in New York, I think it underscores it. Once you're aware of this dichotomy of philosophies, you're gonna recognize it when you hear it or see it. And you're gonna go, oh, I get that one. That's the limited resource one. And if you have a limited resource, then it means that somebody somewhere has to make a decision about who gets and who gets not, who doesn't. And what does that sound like? Which party does that sound like? To me, it sounds like the Democrat Party, where they're saying, these people get this, these people don't. And it can be as random as they want, and they can justify it because they're in charge.
Well, and so let's take a look at this this triage team that this communication from the state of Colorado says that will be the decision makers. It says that it will consist of an expert on ethics or palliative care, an attending physician familiar with critical care, for example, a hospitalist or critical care physician, a representative of the nursing staff, and a representative of the hospital's leadership. It said the primary medical team caring for a patient should not be involved in crisis triage decision-making for their own patient. Each institution should create a crisis triage team that is objective and removed from the patient. What's your thoughts about that, Jill?
Isn't that just, that is absolute Plato. It is the opposite of the Hippocratic Oath that I took. It is every decision that I like to think that the decisions that I make about my patients are based on what's best for that patient to the best of my knowledge. So if I have a cancer patient, a new diagnosis of cancer, I talk to her, I explain to her her options, and she may say, I want to do this, or I don't want to do this, or I want to have my biopsy surgically, I don't want to do the needle biopsy, whatever. She may say, this is what I really believe. We do informed consent. I make sure she understands the pluses and minuses, risks and benefits of what we're talking about. She makes a decision. I honor that decision. It is about individual patients. And the idea that you're going to make decisions, let's say the system was overwhelmed. Let's say the system was overwhelmed and you had 10 patients. You were short 10 ventilators. So you had 10 patients that needed ventilators that couldn't get them. And you are not going to consider that individual patient's circumstances in making this decision? Wow. That seems incredibly, because there could be some patients that said, that could say, yeah, excuse me, you know, honestly, you know, I'm okay, or this is an elderly parent or whatever, you know, it could be, I'm having issues with the, you know, just go ahead. I'll give this to somebody else. You know, allow patients to at least make some kind of decision like that. They're assuming here that everybody would be grappling and fighting and throwing each other on the floor to get on the ventilator and toss everybody else under the bus. And that's not necessarily the case. They're not even allowing people to make a decision that's in the patient's best interest, or for the patient's caregivers, immediate caregivers, to talk to this group and say, I know that this is how my patient's feeling, or let me talk to this patient. And you know what I mean? They're just acting like we know better than everybody else. And who does that sound like? We know better than everybody else. Sounds like our politicians. And we're better at making decisions than you are. That's what we are being told. That's what we've been being told since the Clinton era, at least. It's like this set of elites is going to be better. They know better how to make decisions for us and everybody else. Better than we do. Yeah. So, you know, just sit back there and I'll tell you what can and can't happen to you. And don't bother me. We'll make this decision. We're going to sit in this little room and we're going to make these decisions.
You know, Jill,
it's the opposite of what I was trained to do.
Well, and as you're talking about this, I'm realizing that this isn't just to this particular standards of care. I mean, you can basically just copy and paste what you've just described to the way that these public health departments have been weaponized against everyday individuals being able to go out and work and to assemble. And, you know, I think that this forced face covering thing, which these face coverings are 97% ineffective, but it basically looks to me like sit down and shut up. We're going to tell you what to do. And then you look at who they have here as the decision maker about these people's lives, and it doesn't have the physician that's taking care of the person. It doesn't have a family member. It doesn't have the patient involved. And then the term patient advocate, I'd like to break that down a little bit, because if it says patient and advocate, that would make one think that they care about the patient and they're the ones that's at the table is speaking on behalf of the patient. But recently I talked with a man whose wife has been in the hospital. He's not been able to see her. And he talked to the patient advocate, and he said the patient advocate, it took days for the patient advocate to return a call. And when they did, they were flippant. They were not helpful. But even in this list of people, there's not a patient advocate. Talk a little bit about that, Dr. Jill.
Who pays for the patient advocate? The hospital.
The hospital. Oh.
Does
follow
anything
the
else
money.
Need to be said? Nothing, yeah, nothing else needs to be said. Who pays for the patient advocate? The patient advocate is risk management. The patient advocate is there so the hospital doesn't get sued, or to try to minimize the chances that the hospital will get sued. So instead of having a lawyer in the room, they have a patient advocate in the room. So, no, a patient advocate. Now, actually, folks should maybe know this. There are a few. I've met one, and she said there are a small group of people like her. She and I she was an intern when I was a medical student, in internal medicine, and, ran into her years later, and she was a paid by the patient advocate. So if there was a real issue with the hospital or some medical issue, with a caregiving team or something, Heidi acts as a real advocate for the patient, and the patient pays her a small fee. So she can coordinate care. She can help find caregivers that will work well together. She can help to resolve conflicts, billing issues. I thought that was an absolutely fascinating profession or career choice. Because and she's a physician, a trained physician, and a super smart gal. I remember that. That's what a real patient advocate is. Somebody who could go into the hospital and say, I am representing this patient, and if you need to listen to us. A patient advocate that's paid by the hospital, most of the time, they maybe have a bachelor's degree, I mean, honestly, or they're a social worker. Most of the time, they're a social worker. So they may have a master's in social work or something, but really, I mean, they're not going to, and I'm not downplaying social workers. They play critical roles, but they are not going to get in the face of a hospital administrator that's paying their, writing their check. So, yeah, the patient advocates can be helpful, but most of the time, they're not going to be able to do sometimes what may be necessary. And in this gentleman's case, based on the article that you sent me, sorry about that background noise, but based on the article you sent me, that patient advocate obviously wasn't doing anything helpful for that gentleman at all.
Precisely. So let's go back here. We talked about the triage team. This is who the state of Colorado says will be making decisions about, for the example, would be who gets a ventilator and who doesn't if we got into a situation where there were limited resources. To that point, let's also realize that the radical activists that have taken over the Democrat Party, they only see limited resources, Jill. They don't see it. So Cuomo doesn't see it. He goes, I don't have enough ventilators. I need 14,000. And then the other thought is that of creativity and innovation. And so Donald Trump says, you need ventilators? We'll get you ventilators. And the left never looks at the creativity and innovation of the human mind. They only see this limited resource, whereas somebody like a Donald Trump says, we need them, we'll figure out how to get them. And that's such a stark contrast between those two schools of thought. It just goes back to what you were just talking about between Socrates and Plato.
Exactly. And let's face it, the COVID-19 has just really, I think, thrown into sharp perspective the differences between the left and the right ways of thinking about the world. The left is victimization. Somebody has to, everything's a crisis. Everybody's a victim. Somebody has to take control. Centralized power. Systems crashing. Oh, my gosh. Emergency. Let no crisis go to waste. Draconian measures. Control. That's the left. The right is, we've got this issue. Let's find out about it. Set priorities. Solve the problem. Trump is all about answer the question, solve the problem. That's my mantra. Answer the question, solve the problem. Don't tell me it can't be done. Tell me how it can be done. And then it's all on Trump time, right? So he's got his own system, and this is why he's the perfect person, in my opinion, to have in charge for all this. That what was accomplished in 2 months has been absolutely miraculous in this country as far as medical innovation, manufacturing, unbelievable. I mean, from a medical perspective, unbelievable. And every doctor I've talked to, regardless of which side of the aisle they might be on or how much they love or hate Trump, they have never seen anything like this, and they're just agog. This is amazing what's happened here. The okay. left, on the other hand, everything has to be a disaster, a crisis. And for everything that Trump accomplished, they put something else in front of him. That's not good enough. You have to do this. That's not good enough. Help, help. We have to have this. So that they were just wanted him to fail at something, and he kind of hasn't. So
yeah, it's astounding, the situation. Well, I think they are. Let's go back to one other thing I wanted to mention on this. We talked about the triage team and the standard of care, but interestingly, it says that it gives them parameters that says a triage team should not base decisions on factors clinically or ethically irrelevant to the triage process. For example, race, ethnicity, ability to pay, disability status, national origin, primary language, immigration status, sexual orientation, gender identity, HIV status, religion, veteran status, VIP status, criminal history. You know, they continue to divide and define people instead of looking at people as individuals. What's your thoughts on this, Jill?
Well, you have to, again, medically limited resources. If it was truly, you have to be able to separate out who's going to get and who's not going to get. And this particular standard of care document seemed to kind of contradict itself in some ways, because when you triage patients, just in the emergency room, this happens all the time. If an emergency room is packed full, how many times? Yes, emergency rooms are packed full. Who you have to triage, you have to decide who gets treatment first. So gunshot wound comes in, they're going to be way before somebody who has a sprained ankle. You have to do that. That's medically indicated. It makes sense, common sense, and all that, right? So they're doing the same thing with this, but you're going to have to decide who does and doesn't get. And it's kind of like with the disability status. What is that? That's a PC term, obviously. It's political correctness. But obviously, if somebody is severely disabled, they're probably going to be a little more at risk of not getting that ventilator than somebody who is, an otherwise was a walkie-talkie, fully functional self-employed, like employer with a family of four. You know, and in medical school, we had these ongoing ethics courses, classes, very, kind of group discussions that went on for a couple of years that were really valuable, because you have to have some of those discussions. Things like the transplant list, right? If there's a transplant list and you've got three patients that all have tissue matches for a lung transplant, who's going to get that? The person who never quit smoking, or the person who is a farmer and had farmer's lung and is 70 years old with chronic exposures and high blood pressure, cholesterol, all that? Or is it going to be the young, healthy kid? Or what if the young, healthy kid is really psychologically messed up, mentally ill or something? So, see, it's all of these dilemmas, right? That's what medical ethics is really all about. And so you have to use those processes, you have to have those discussions and go through those decision-making trees in order to triage. And it's never a pleasant process if it really has to be done intensely. But to base it on some kind of political correctness criteria is ridiculous. I mean, it's fine for them to say we're not going to, and legally they have to, in a standard of care, they're going to have to eliminate. They're going to have all these things where we're not going to base this on race, gender, ethnicity. You know, of course, they didn't say really, it's funny, they didn't say religious beliefs in there. Isn't that funny? And let's face it, somebody with VIP status, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, you tell me they're not going to get first choice. Veteran status. It does say religion. I'm sorry. It does say religion. And veteran status is kind of like, oh, I think they're VIPs. But anyway, yeah. So they have to, from a legal standpoint, I'm sure that's where this list came from. But sometimes you just look at some of the political correctness and you just shake your head, wishing it didn't always have to be in your face, just wishing it all wasn't always there.
Well, and actually, if we could just look at people as individuals instead of all these descriptors or definitions, but yet that's what they use to try to divide us. And a house divided against itself cannot stand. We're just about out of time, Jill. I find that This is actually really good stuff that we are seeing put into writing, these different things, these agendas, where the radical activists left, they have said to people, we care about you. But when we now look at the policies, not so much. We look at what we were just talking about, this crisis standards of care, or they don't seem to have any compunction about shutting down our businesses, or we've talked about this, shutting down just your day-to-day medical procedures such as breast imaging to detect breast cancer. And that was kind of one of the final thoughts that we wanted to talk about, is think of all the deaths that are occurring because people have not had routine, checkups and different testing. So let's finish up with that, Jill. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, one other comment. In order, when the left says we want to take care of you. What they're really saying is, in order to take care of you, you have to give me control over you. That's the whole MO, is to gain control, and the way they do that is by saying, I'm going to take care of you. But again, the most important thing with the opening up of the state is how many patients are we going to find that they're going to have much more extensive treatment because their cancers are 2 and 3 months delayed in diagnosis. Between colonoscopy, breast cancer, hundreds of people just in Colorado. Over this period of time, hundreds of people just in Colorado are going to have more, sometimes much more advanced cancers that could be life-threatening now, whereas 3 months ago they would not have been. And they're going to have to go through chemotherapy, more extensive surgeries, and maybe unsuccessful treatment because we had lawmakers who chose to overreact and exert power-hungry, draconian control measures rather than being reasonable and allowing people to make their own decisions, risk-benefit decisions. And you really want to think that they should maybe be held accountable. You want to have blood on your hands. Is there some way to hold these people accountable?
Wow. Okay, with that, Jill, we are out of time. This is Kim Munson. This is Sounding Off with Kim Munson, talking with Dr. Jill Vecchio. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.